good morning. Welcome for Computer Graphics. We will today speak about secondary effects in ray tracing. So on Monday, I was explaining the idea of ray tracing, in particular ray casting, which mainly is a different way to generate the same images which we could generate with rasterization. But I also said that having this ray tracing operator available allows us to achieve many more nice effects, yeah, which just increase realism and make images looking better and improve on quality. And while last time we only looked at, or mainly looked at eye rays, yeah, today we will look at secondary effects at these secondary rays. So today we will not only shoot rays from the eye into our scene, but also within the scene to do lighting computations. And so while last time we were only casting rays through the single pixels and then shading the single hit points, yeah, today we will, that's just a repetition of what we saw before. Yeah, so we traverse the image pixel by pixel and cast the rays. And last time we only had eye rays, but today we also have that situation that we shoot rays and then cast secondary rays. For instance, to obtain shadows, but also to get reflections or refractions. We already also saw this, and you also saw these images. This allows us to get all these nice reflection effects, reflecting spheres, and so forth. Okay, so this you've all seen. And now a basic ray tracer, and this reminds me that I should have started because last time I skipped two slides for time due to time constraints, but we can do that now very well. Okay, how do we Okay, we also saw this, yeah, and so this is pure ray casting. Yeah, this is the state, kind of the algorithmic state that we had at the end of the last lecture. Yeah, so we have a loop that goes over every pixel in an image, generates eye ray. Then here in a loop, it iterates over all the scene objects, intersects the eye ray with the scene objects. And then if we found a hit point, this O min is kind of the object that has been hit first, yeah, that has the closest hit point, the hit point with a minimal ray parameter, and then we compute the lighting at this hit point. So you see this code is very, very pseudo, yeah, it's very abstract, and in practice, what we typically need now at this point to compute the lighting, yeah, at the hit point, is that we need information about the hit point. Yeah, to do the lighting. If you remember in rasterization, we had the situation that we have a triangle and we have normals at the vertices. And then during rasterization, for instance, the normals are interpolated and then we have a normal at this point and then we can do the lighting here. Yeah, this would be Phong lighting. That's the normal way per pixel lighting to do lighting. Now the situation is a little bit different. Yeah, we have our triangle, and now we cast the ray, and we get exactly this hit point. Yeah, and now we have to do the lighting at that point. And first of all, that means that we have to compute the interpolated normal at that point. Yeah, and we need information about that point. We need its position to compute the vectors to the light sources, for instance, or the viewing vectors, yeah, the vector to the camera. We need the normal at this point. Probably we also need texture coordinates and so forth. Yeah, and we cannot interp or, yeah, here we did a incremental interpolation, but here we have to compute these explicitly. Yeah? By computing for each hit point the barycentric coordinates, for instance, and then doing the interpolation. And in practice, this is usually done using a hit point object. Yeah? So that when we cast our array into the scene and we get a hit point, what we get returned is not only the ray parameter, yeah, but an object that gives us all the necessary information of that particular hit point. And in particular, it can tell us the position of that point, it gives us the normal of that point, the texture coordinate, and so forth. And this is such a hit object, yeah? It describes the hit of a ray with our scene. And for instance, we know the ray parameter for that hit, we know the object that has been hit, we know the barycentric coordinates maybe, yeah, and we can ask or query the position, the normal, the texture coordinate, and so forth of the hit point. And with such an object, we can abstract from the geometry. Yeah, so if we have, for instance, a triangle and our ray hits that triangle, probably the way the position and the normal and the texture coordinate are computed is different from if we have a sphere object and our ray hits that sphere. Yeah, because then the normal, for instance, can directly be computed from the position. So the normal will be different and also texture coordinates will be different. And so this is how this will look in practice. We have such a hit object and our scene, which is then a collection, yeah, or a scene graph, a collection of objects, will have a method intersect, and this method gets as parameter such a ray, yeah, and then it returns the hit, yeah, the first hit point of that ray with our scene. Yeah, and now our loop will look like that, here we generate our I ray, and then we call all this part here, yeah, is sort of hidden in that intersect method, and as a result we get the hit point. And this hit point then we use to do the lighting. Yeah, we somehow here compute the lighting. So here you see now that's already that's this code. Yeah, we compute these hits. In that example, our scene doesn't have that hit method yet, so we take all the objects of the scene and compute the hit. And with the information from that hit, we call the shader and compute the lighting for that particular hit point. Yeah? Okay, that's a programming detail, but just to make things clear. This is where we are now. If we do ray tracing, yeah? Now, if we also cast secondary rays, yeah, our code, sorry, that's really, that's a bad choice. I mean, here on my screen, it's definitely much better, but. Yeah, I think that's better. Okay. So how does that look now? So our outer loop, again, goes over all pixels, then it computes an I-ray, and then it simply calls a method ray trace. And this ray tracing now here is a recursive method. Recursive because imagine you have an I-ray that hits a reflective surface, you compute the reflection ray, and now you just recursively call a method that again computes the color of this reflected ray. Yeah, because it's just like an I ray. It's a new ray that starts in the scene and we compute the color for that ray and we take this color as a reflection. So now we have a recursive method. Yeah. And this method is called ray trace. The method casts a ray in the scene. Yeah, that's the scene intersection method. And if a hit point, now we assume a hit point has been found, and now we compute the color for that point. And this color now has multiple components. It's not only the direct lighting, yeah, not only evaluating the Phong model at this point, yeah, which comes here at the bottom of the code, but before we also cast these additional rays. And so, for instance, the first thing is that we look whether the surface is reflective in the sense that it's a mirror. And if this is the case, we compute a reflection ray, and now we recursively call the method ray trace, but now with a reflection ray. Yeah? And this gives us a color, and we multiply that color with a reflection color, and we sum all this up in a color C, yeah, which in the beginning is black. Now here we add the color of the reflection ray. We do the same with refraction. Yeah, if the surface is refractive, then we compute the refraction ray and again call ray tracing. Yeah, and then we add the color multiplied with a refraction color. And now you see here with this depth parameter, we also count the reflection depth. So how many reflections do we already have? And in fact, we only cast new recursion rays, yeah, if depth is below a certain threshold. Yeah, and this max depth tells us how many reflections do we compute. The reason to do so is because if we do recursion, we always need an end of recursion. And of course, now if you have a scene or a room which is completely mirrored, yeah, but that has mirrors all around, or all objects are mirroring, then we would never have an end in recursion. Making a just maximum recursion depth is definitely not the smartest way. There are better methods. For instance, it is known that every surface always, or normal physical surfaces never reflect 100% of the light. Yeah, so every reflection reduces the amount of light that can be transported. So for instance, we can simply stop if we are below some threshold in the accumulated reflectances and so forth. But for now, we just stop at a certain depth. And now we have the reflection edit, we have the refraction edit. Next, we compute a shadow ray. That means we cast a ray from our surface point to, yeah, the light source. In that example, we only have one light source. Yeah? If we have multiple light sources, we cast a ray to each light source. And this gives us information about the shadow. Yeah? And if there is an intersection of that shadow ray with the scene, we simply take the ambient color in that case of our shader. Yeah, the ambient color is the color that is always at a point. Yeah, if you remember the Phong model, it's the color that comes from the environment somehow. Yeah, so we just take this color, but not the direct illumination. Yeah, so we only take that ambient color so that also objects in shadow are sort of visible, yeah, and not completely black. And for the others, which are not in shadow, which are lit by the light source, we do the normal Phong computation. Yeah. And so now we get images like these, for instance. Yeah. Like these, we have shadows. So these pixels here, for these pixels, the shadow ray got blocked by that object here. And so you see it's darker, but if you look at the real images or also here, you see that it's not completely black because there's an ambient color chosen for this checkerboard here. Yeah. Of course, there are also smarter ways what to do in shadow, yeah, but this would then require real indirect illumination computation, which we don't have yet for now. And the reflection rays generate these patterns, and the refraction rays, yeah, that's what I also already said. Typically, a refraction ray gets into an object, and then it travels within the object, and when exiting the object, it's again refracted. And this double, yeah, refraction happens during the recursion, because the refracted ray recursively calls the method ray trace. Yeah, then it travels through there, and then it again gets a refraction. It generates this new ray and calls ray trace for this one, And then when coming back from the recursion, the results are summed up and give the result for my entire array. Okay, so that's the basic structure. Yeah, you see, it's not too complicated. And the important part, yeah, we always need this method intersect, yeah, or somehow have to intersect our arrays with a scene. So here and here, yeah, and these are not rays from the eyes only, but rays that really scatter around in the entire scene, yeah, and that sort of gather light and that give us these nice lighting effects, yeah. So it will be important in terms of computation time, or in fact, in terms of computation time, most of the time is spent in these intersect calls, yeah, and they are, yeah, they have to do quite a bit, yeah. It's really the task to intersect a line segment with the entire scene, and the scene can be rather complicated. Yeah, each of these calls intersects array with possibly all objects in a scene, millions of triangles maybe. And next week we will see how we can do that rather efficiently. But nevertheless, as I already mentioned quite a few times, ray tracing is much slower than rasterization, except in very few borderline cases. Okay, good. So that's the general idea. Now let's look at a few technical issues maybe. So first of all, we can look at the impact of that maximum depth parameter, yeah, that stops reflections after, or yeah, secondary rays after a certain recursion depth. So here, for instance, we have a few examples of a scene, yeah, a few spheres. And these walls here are mirror walls, but now here we have a maximum depth of zero. So that means have no secondary rays at all. And if we increase that depth to one here, now we get mirror reflections on this and on this mirror. But in fact, if we go to two, we see that now here a kind of tertiary reflection is missing here. Yeah. So this image happens by rays that are first reflected here and then here and then go to the eye or from the eye, yeah, that are first reflected here and then hit the surface or see the surface from behind. Yeah, and if you have a real room with multiple mirrors and so forth, then probably you will need a larger maximal depth. But on the other hand, yeah, one has to consider that a large depth will also, yeah, increase computation time probably. Because at every step, yeah, in the process that we have here, for each ray that hits a surface, if we have a reflective surface, we cast a reflective ray, then maybe a refractive ray, and a shadow ray. Yeah, so possibly at each hit point, yeah, we get three new rays. We spawn three new rays, and each of these again generates three new rays. Yeah, so we have a tree of such cast rays. And you know, the size of trees increases very fast with the depth. Yeah, and so we very quickly get very many rays. So here we can see a visualization. Yeah, how this tree of rays looks like. Yeah, so we start with an eye ray through our pixel from the camera. We hit that object. So from here we cast a shadow ray to a light source, and in fact in this example we have two light sources. Yeah, so we have that shadow ray and that shadow ray. This is blocked, by the way. Then we have a reflection ray, that's this one, and a refraction ray, that's this one. And for the reflection ray, again, we cast a shadow ray to both light sources. We get a reflection and a refraction. And for that transmission ray, we also get a hit point, a shadow ray, a reflection ray, and a refraction ray. Yeah, and you can imagine, yeah, if we get now go one step further, yeah, it gets more and more rays. And we are still only computing the color for one pixel. Yeah, and this is a what we call a ray tree. Yeah, we start with one single ray, the I ray, and then each hit point can generate new rays. So this is a little bit visualized here. So we have an I ray, it hits an object. We have the shadow rays. Shadow rays have the nice property that they don't spawn new rays. Yeah, it's a shadow ray doesn't in its when a shadow is computed, yeah, it doesn't recursively spawn new rays. That's why they are drawn here on the side, but we also have a reflection ray and a refraction ray, and these spawn again new ones. They hit a hit point, again new shadow rays here and here, and they this one spawns a reflection ray, and this a refraction and reflection ray. So this surface here is only reflective but not refractive, so there's no refraction ray. Yeah, and this also shows why at some point we have to cut that tree. Yeah, and just be sure that we don't get in a situation where, whatever, for instance, a ray just always bounces between two reflective objects, yeah, two mirror objects, and gets stuck, and we get infinite recursion. That's what is absolutely to be avoided. Yeah, and here, now, the situation from before, and here a visualization of the ray tree for that example. Okay, good. So that's our tree, and now a few technical issues before in the end we will make a little glimpse into how we can even extend that further, by using better models for reflection, by using other types of light sources and so forth. In fact, that what we do today about secondary rays, it's really only the start. It's like it was already presented in the 80s in the first ray tracing papers, that only doing mirroring and refraction and shadows, that's the easiest part, but there are many other things we can do with ray tracing, in particular also compute indirect light, we spoke about that, and caustics and so on. And if you're interested in that stuff, we have a lecture, Global Illumination, that always happens in summer. And there we look at then all these much more fancy operators. Yeah, so here we really only do the simple stuff for secondary rays. Okay, a few technical things. So first of all, when you implement a simple ray tracer, probably the most interesting effect are shadows. Yeah, and if you now compute shadows with your ray tracer, it's rather likely that you get images like this here. And now, of course, it won't take long until you find out the following problem. If I cast a shadow ray, that shadow ray will start on a surface. Yeah, I have here my surface. This is the object that generates a shadow. This is my camera. Yeah, and this is about the shadow range. Now, if I cast a ray here, or my I ray hits here, I want to find an intersection, or I'm looking for an intersection for that shadow ray, and here I will find out it's in shadow, and it's fine. But if I now look at such a point here, which is not in shadow, I cast a ray to here. Obviously, sometimes I get the information it is blocked. Yeah? And the reason is very simple, because the ray starts on the surface, sometimes due to precision problems. Yeah? We are always doing computations in float, which is not very precise, only 5 digits of precision. So it can easily happen that the ray says, okay, there is a hit point at t equals 0.000001, for instance. Yeah? And so it sees an intersection, because in its precision, the starting point or the hit point of the I ray is not here, but here. Yeah? And then if a new ray is shot to the light source, it sees this hit point here as an intersection point. Yeah? So that's why it's also called self-shadowing, because the surface here shadows itself. just due to imprecision or precision issues. Okay, well, I mean, the effect is rather easy to understand, and it's also rather obvious how we can handle that. There are a few variants, that all are based on the same idea. So one is, whenever we compute an intersection point with a surface, we don't take the intersection point that we get, but we always go an epsilon back, towards the I, so that the point we are shading is in fact just a little bit above the surface. So it doesn't make a big difference for the shading. Of course, we take the normal of the surface, but the point itself is a little bit above. And the epsilon is chosen such that such issues here can be avoided. It's just moved away by some epsilon. This epsilon usually is a global parameter that is set for your entire ray tracer. An alternative would be that if we cast such a shadow ray, we say, maybe you remember for the rays, we always had, when we intersect, we usually provide an interval of ray parameters for which we want intersections. And for a shadow ray, now we could say, okay, we don't look for intersections, or we only look for intersections that start at a certain ray parameter epsilon. So in that case, if epsilon, for instance, is chosen of this size, then we only start to look for intersections beyond that epsilon, and that one is automatically filtered out. Okay, that's, that sort of works, but you always should be aware that, of course, there are always problems possible, or we can take that one. If we now, for instance, have a light source here, and we cast a ray, then obviously this epsilon won't be enough anymore. Then here this point still is underneath the surface, just due to this angle. On the other hand, in this direction, almost no light arrives anyhow anymore, because the cosine is almost zero, so it's probably less visible, but it's always a little bit trade-off, and always problems can appear. So in terms of robustness, this is something you have to look at. For shadow rays, there is another interesting optimization that helps to reduce the number for the intersections, and that is the following. For shadow rays, for us it is interesting, or we don't really want to know the first intersection of a ray, but we only want to know whether there is an intersection. So you remember for I rays, if an I ray hits multiple objects, we want to know the first one because that's the visible one. So even if we found a hit point, we cannot stop, because we have to test the other objects. Maybe there's an intersection point in front. For shadow rays, as soon as we found an intersection in the right interval, we can stop, because it doesn't matter for us, if we found this hit point, for instance, of that ray, we can stop because it doesn't matter that there's another object. If the light source is occluded, it doesn't matter whether it's occluded by one or by two objects and in which order. We only need to know whether there is any one intersection. So usually we have a special method for shadow rays, to intersect the scene with a shadow ray that is faster, because it can immediately stop as soon as it found an intersection. And it only returns back there was a hit point or there was no hit point, and not with no guarantee that it's the first hit point. Okay, now here again, or a simple example how these shadows look like. And in fact, that image is not very good at this place because obviously the light source here is not a point light source, but an area light source. So these sharp shadows are in that case wrong. Okay, reflections. They give us this mirror contribution, as we can see it here. Yeah. Now for reflection rays, the question is, how do we compute the reflection direction? We already spoke about that for the Phong lighting model, and we know the corresponding formulas, yeah, how to compute the reflection direction. And furthermore, what we typically have to define now, not for mirroring objects, is a reflection coefficient. That is a coefficient that tells us how much of the light is reflected via mirroring. So a perfect mirror would have 100%, but a real mirror has less. And sometimes you have very shiny surfaces, yeah, that are perfect mirrors, but not by 100%, but maybe just by 20% or so, yeah, like the hood of a car, for instance. Yeah, it can work like a mirror, but it's not a perfect mirror, but it has a mirroring component. So we also have to define such a reflection coefficient. Okay, and now, in fact, you remember also from better BRDF models, where we were already speaking about, or reflection models, that for normal materials, yeah, the fraction of reflected light is not constant, but also depends on the incident angle. So we have the Fresnel model for that. And in fact, we have to consider that, to be physically correct, we have to consider that at this place, and I will come back to that later. Okay, so computing the reflection direction, we had that formula already, just with a different picture, so that's rather easy to compute. And yeah, then we can generate images like that. I mean, you see it's 92, yeah, it was from a time where it was fantastic to see reflections, very artificial scene. It's called snowflake. Yeah, okay. The perfect image for today. Okay, and for these reflection rays, we have exactly the same problem like here. Of course, again, now it can happen that such a reflection ray also starts at a surface. So again, we have to be careful that the ray doesn't immediately get stuck at the very same surface. Yeah. So again, we don't have to forget the epsilon. Otherwise, our image will look like that, yeah, which is not what we want. And for transparency, yeah, I think you can imagine how it works. For every hit point, we cast a ray in the direction of refraction. That means we need to compute that direction of refraction. And then we can sum this up. So we take the normal, as a final result, we take the normal lighting at x, yeah, plus the, so that would be the Phong model or whatever we have for normal lighting, plus the mirrored light, plus the refracted light. And here we also need such a special coefficient. And now the question is, how do we compute the refraction direction? Yeah. And refraction is different from reflection because it depends also on optical densities. So we only have refraction at the surface between two materials with different optical densities. Yeah, and I think I've also already shown these images. Yeah, that a result of refraction is that, for instance, a stick in water seems to be bent here because the lights are bent like here. Yeah, when they hit, light rays are bent when they hit a surface. So from the outside, for instance, it looks like that fish here, which is in fact here, yeah, is at a different position. And yeah, this refraction, yeah, how much this light is bent depends on the refractive index of the mediums. Yeah, for air, it's usually 1, and for water, yeah, it even depends on the salt content and probably even on the temperature, I don't know. But there's a simple formula to describe that, and this is Snell's law, and it says, it looks at these angles here, and you know for reflection, we said these angles are the same, and now for refraction, these angles change, and they change, or the sign of these angles changes by the ratio of the optical densities. Yeah, this is Snell's law, and in fact, this formula allows us to change how the sign changes, and from these changes of the sign, we have to compute the changes of the refractions. There are formulas available to do that, that means if we have such a surface and we want to compute refraction, we also, as a material parameter, have to store this relative optical index with a surface. It's a material parameter now, and that allows us to compute that refraction. And just as an example, I was already speaking about shader toy. There is a nice demo. There's a nice demo. Oh, that's very dark. There's a nice demo in Shader Toy, and at some point it will pop up. Okay, connection is very slow. Here we are. Okay, and obviously it doesn't work. Ah, here it is. Yeah. So this is a ray tracer implemented in a shader. Yeah, that's a kind of bringing ray tracing and rasterization together. So what is done here is that a rectangle is rasterized that covers the entire screen. So for each pixel, a shader is called, a pixel shader, and in this pixel shader, complete ray tracing is implemented. Yeah, that's a kind of nice way to integrate ray tracing in Shader Toy, and GPUs are very fast, so all these computations can also be done on a GPU efficiently. And so in this example now, a water surface is simulated, and then a ray tracing happens, and you can, of course, see the reflections, and maybe you can also guess that there a refraction is happening. I mean, it's sort of hidden by the waves, but there's also this refractive effect that the that rays are bent when they here hit the surface. Yeah, and of course, there's also a normal lighting on these surfaces, so this looks like normal Phong lighting. That's also going on, and additionally we have all these nice recursions. And if you look at the code of that demo, you will see all the formulas for computing the refracted rays and all that stuff. But this is not, I mean, I find that one particularly nice, but there are hundreds of such ray tracing demos where you can find examples. Okay. Good. Now, again, a little remark which we already spoke about when we spoke about the Phong model and other lighting models. And that is that, in fact, if we look at reflection and refraction, to do that physically correct, we also have to look at the Fresnel equations, because they just tell us, for light incident from a particular direction, so if we have light here from a light source that hits, for instance, here a water surface, which fraction of the light is reflected and which fraction is refracted. And we saw these formulas. I already spoke about them, and you see them here, and here these N1, N2 are again the optical densities. So N1 is the optical density of the, where the ray comes from, N2 is the one after that hit point, the optical density. Yeah? And yeah, the formulas are not very simple, and they depend on polarization. I was also speaking about that. If we have unpolarized light, we have to compute the two and just take the average. And there is a simple approximation. Yeah, we saw all these slides already by Schlick, who does that in a rather, or approximates that in a way that is much faster to compute and works pretty well in practice. Okay, and here again, we also saw these, yeah, that this behavior is very different for things like metal, for instance, or for dielectric objects. Yeah, these terms can look very different, but it's also important to consider them. Yeah, if it's physically correct, then it also looks more correct and is more correct. Okay, that was kind of rather fast secondary. Yeah, what can we do with secondary rays? I mean, it's rather clear how to handle shadow rays and so forth. For reflections and refractions, we can also now bring in physical knowledge. How to do that? Now in the second half, I would just make a little kind of preview, yeah, of what else can we do with secondary rays now. Yeah? And how can we go beyond what we saw here? And yeah, I would like to look at three subtopics that are maybe immediately interesting for that part. So first of all, how do we describe reflectance? And I also already spoke about that when we looked at lighting. I just want to bring it up here at this place because, in fact, if we look at secondary rays now, yeah, we have an I ray, and now we reflect this ray. Okay, this is not the best direction. Yeah, this is this here. And that means somehow we simulate the reflection here at this point. Yeah, and if we have a perfectly mirroring surface, that's rather simple, but for other surfaces, yeah, if we have, for instance, here a light source, and we cast now a shadow ray, yeah, now we somehow need to know how much light from this light source from here is reflected at this point towards the eye. Yeah? So this is exactly the place where we need this BRDF, this function that describes reflection at a surface point. Yeah? And we will always have an incident ray, yeah, usually an I ray, and an excitant ray. And the BRDF describes how much light is transported for light coming from here and reflected into this direction. Yeah? So the BRDF is exactly the function that describes the coupling of rays in ray tracing. And so the BRDF can be defined physically. So when we were looking at BRDFs in the lighting chapter, or even in Phong lighting, yeah, we never really spoke about physical units. Yeah, I use terms like intensity, for instance, and stuff like that. And now, in fact, if we really want to describe these BRDFs correctly, and also want to use physical terms to argument and do the simulations in a physically correct manner, the first thing what we would need are physical units for light. We don't have that here, and in fact it's not so simple to describe light with physical units. And here I will also refer to the lecture Global Illumination. And if we have these physical units like irradiance, radiance, intensity, and so forth, we can also describe BRDFs physically with such a term here. Yeah, and you see it, yeah, it can quickly become, yeah, well, it's maybe not so intuitive as you might think in the very beginning. Okay, but that's just a kind of preview to Global Illumination, what we will speak about. Nevertheless, I think we can we can look at what is possible with that. Yeah, you saw that typically we look at three different types of BRDFs for the reflection. We have the perfect specular reflection, that would be the perfect mirror. In rasterization, we spoke about that it's not possible to simulate that with rasterization, or not easily. With ray tracing, we can do that very easily, yeah, just by casting a secondary ray. Then we have perfect diffuse reflection, yeah, and glossy reflection. And so the Phong model is one model to describe these, for instance, but we also saw Torrance-Sparrow using these normal distributions, and there are many more objects. And in fact, all these models here, Blinn, Phong, Torrance-Sparrow, Ward, and this Disney BRDF, I think I've already shown that image, but I will explain it briefly again, are also sort of, in particular, this BRDF here from Ward is specifically designed to be used in ray tracing. Yeah. So that it can be used to optimize ray tracing in a certain manner, important sampling. We will also speak about that in global illumination. Disney BRDF is a BRDF that you can see here, or we can see here different samples, and it's a kind of generalization of the Phong model, but using physical terms. Or it can also be seen as a specialization of Torrance-Sparrow, where the distribution of normals and so forth is not kept as a general function, but by parameterized functions. So for the normal distributions, for instance, often Gauss distributions are used, and with the width of the, or with the size of the Gauss kernel, for instance, one can control how specular an object is and how rough. You can control the roughness. And then there are different ways to reflect light, for instance, whether the reflection has the, or whether the specular reflected light has the base color of the object, or whether it's white. That's a differentiation between more plastic and more metallic looking surfaces. Yeah, and all this stuff is brought together. All parameters are mapped to a range from 0 to 1, which is also very helpful for artists. So it doesn't have physical meanings, yeah, but it just means 0 effect turned off, 1 maximum, and it's chosen in a way such they try to have a linear behavior, yeah, so that 0.5 shows the effect at roughly 50%, yeah, which is always very subjective. Altogether this model has 10 parameters, it's called the Disney BRDF because it has been invented by people from Disney, and they use it throughout all their movies, obviously, yeah, for describing the reflectance of surfaces, and yeah, it's a very practical way to describe such BRDFs. But there are, as I said, there are many, many other ways to describe these BRDFs, and another option is just to measure realistic BRDFs, to take real objects, real samples, and to measure their reflectance behavior. So ideally take a material probe, put it into that device, yeah, press a button, and 5 minutes later you can use that BRDF in your animation or whatever you want to do. In practice, that takes much longer. There are devices that measure the reflectance for a large range of light positions and viewing directions, yeah, and these light source then has to be positioned by a robot at many different positions, and also a camera, and then all these samples need to be transformed to a large table where this BRDF is described, and because the BRDF is four-dimensional, that table is very big, so that's a hardly practical way to describe such a BRDF. Here's another example where the BRDF of a face is captured, and here the light source is not really moved by a robot, but it moves in a spiral. So there's a large device around, yeah, where this light source is then moved on a spiral around a face, and the face is recorded under all these different lighting directions, and then for every surface point, BRDF is reconstructed. Yeah, takes long and is rather slow. But measuring BRDFs is a still ongoing topic. Yeah, and in particular with machine learning, there are interesting approaches now that really directly estimate BRDFs from photographs. Yeah, so it can be foreseen that at some point, yeah, it will be possible just to record a little video sequence of a surface, and then an algorithm derives a BRDF from that. But that's, yeah, ongoing research. Okay. So BRDFs are one thing if we want to go to more physically based methods, yeah, which is possible with ray tracing. Maybe I should mention that one that again. If we do ray tracing, now we have the opportunity that we can better consider all these physical effects. Yeah, and having physical plausible BRDFs is one thing that we can do now. Yeah, because we have more options to do that physically correct. And another thing that we have to look at are light sources. And up to now, in our Phong lighting model, yeah, we had these point light sources or parallel light sources, which is a concept that doesn't exist in reality. There's no such thing as a point, yeah, with no physical size, with no extent in space that emits light. Every light source has some extent, yeah, must have some extent. And in fact, normally, for practical reasons, yeah, and because it delivers better light for humans, light sources are large, yeah, like these light tubes here, for instance, or if you have nice ambient light in offices, for instance, yeah, the light sources should be large, yeah, so they make a rather uniform light in our scene. And yeah, so we somehow, yeah, if you want to do realistic rendering, have to consider that. And so, in fact, our situation will more look like this, yeah, that we have an area light source, maybe described by a rectangle, and we have a surface point X, and we look at that point from our view direction, yeah, and now, at this point, light is not only coming from one direction, but from multiple directions, yeah, from all the entire light source. And of course, now we have, yeah, two problems. So first of all, we have to gather the incident light over many ray directions. Yeah. So the BRDF will vary. Yeah. So that point will have another influence than that point. Yeah. Because it reflects via another BRDF. And we don't have a single shadow ray. Yeah. In fact, we have infinitely many shadow rays. Yeah, because we have to check the visibility of each of these points on the surface. We cannot do that with a single shadow ray. So, yeah, how can we do that? And in fact, at least we can describe that mathematically or physically with an equation. Yeah. So we know what we have to compute, and we still then have to think about how can we compute that algorithmically. And let me try and describe this formula here, yeah, that describes the reflection of such an area light source. Yeah, this is exactly this situation here. We have our surface point X, we have a normal N here, and we have that light source, which is, yeah, an area. Yeah, and a surface object. And this formula says now the reflection at this point X into a certain direction omega out. Omega are directions now. Yeah, and out is the outgoing direction at X. That's here, the direction towards the eye. This is omega out. Yeah, this is the direction, a vector pointing into this direction. And now we compute the reflected light at x into this direction. Yeah, this is this L here. L now is the color. In fact, the physical unit is radiance. Yeah, it's called radiance. So we compute the radiance that is emitted at x towards the camera, and this radiance can be computed with this integral here. Why an integral? So the idea is simply we can take arbitrary points on that surface, yeah, and compute how the light from here is reflected towards the eye. Yeah, so we can compute the reflection for arbitrary points, but if we look at the entire surface, we have to integrate that over the entire surface. Yeah, that's why we have an integral here. We integrate over the surface, and now we integrate the contributions from the single points on the surface, on the light source. And for each of these points are called y now. Yeah, y are points on the surface. So we have this emitting surface, yeah, and now y are points on the surface, and we integrate over all y's. And it's an area integral, so this should mean, yeah, we integrate over small surface areas around this y. And it's a two-dimensional integral, yeah, so that makes it maybe even a little bit more difficult to understand, but in fact, yeah, it's I think intuitive. Okay, so now we have a surface point y, and this describes the contribution of one particular surface point. And what do we have here? So first of all, this is the BRDF. This is the BRDF of that particular surface point towards the camera. Yeah, so every surface point here has another incident direction. This is this here. This is the incident direction, yeah, from y to x. Omega out is always the same. This is omega out, yeah, and this is omega xy. And the BRDF, yeah, is just tells us how much light from here is reflected to here. That's obvious that we need that. This is the light that comes from that direction. So in fact, it's the light that is emitted at this point by the light source. Normally, for many cases, we will assume that the light source has a uniform brightness, so this is a constant. This is just how bright is the light source. And then we have two interesting terms. That one is rather simple. That's a visibility term. This tells us is the point y visible for the point x. Yeah, and this reflects that it can happen, of course, that we have here an object which is casting a shadow. And as I already said, yeah, in for an area light, we don't have a single shadow value. We cannot say the light source is visible or it's completely visible or completely occluded. It can also be partially occluded. Yeah, so here we integrate the visibility. This term, yeah, tells us, is there an object between x and y? And if so, the visibility is zero, and if there's nothing in between, it's one. This term is computed by a shadow ray. Yeah, we cast a shadow ray from x to y, and if there is an intersection, then it's zero, and otherwise it's one. Yeah, and for a particular point on the surface, it tells us whether it's in shadow or not. And then we have this geometry term here. And this geometry term, essentially, an important part, or there are two parts, or three parts. The first one, we know from the Phong model and from Lambert, is that the amount of incident light, or the density of the incident light, varies with the incident angle. Yeah, you remember the diffuse term is proportional to the cosine of this angle. Yeah? And this we also have to consider here. You remember that image with the photons? Yeah, and if they hit a surface at a certain angle, the density here, yeah, decreases just, yeah, because of this angle. And this goes with a cosine. So this effect is modeled by a cosine. And this cosine, amongst others, is coded in this what we call geometry term. This function kind of tells us, just from a geometric point of view, yeah, how important is the illumination or the light transport between y and x. And one factor that controls this is the cosine of this angle. This we have here. In fact, this is this Keller product. It's the normal in x times this direction. Another factor is the distance between the two points. You remember for the Phong model, we also had an attenuation term. And I told you from a physical point of view, if this is r, then light is attenuated by 1 over r squared. Yeah, the further away this light source, the less bright is the light that arrives here. Yeah, or the less the reflection that is resulting. This is this term. Yeah, and then there's a third term, and this is the same as this, as the first one, but it's the cosine of the angle at the light source, the corresponding angle. And this has exactly the same effect or the same reason like here. If I have an area light source like this, yeah, or put like this, if I'm illuminated with that area light source like this, yeah, at my nose more light will arrive as if the light source is positioned like this, right? Because just from my point of view here, the light source is smaller. Yeah, there's a smaller angle under which light arrives. Yeah, the light source is smaller like it is in that case. And this also is ruled by a cosine and by this cosine. Essentially, it's exactly the same argument like here. And these three terms now, yeah, this cosine times this cosine over r squared, this is the so-called geometry term. Yeah? And this just kind of considers how are these two points, or how is the light source and the point oriented with respect to each other, and how far are they away. Okay, so this is a formula that is known from physics, yeah, and it can be derived from flux theory and stuff like that, yeah. But it allows us now to write down what we want at least, yeah. And you see there are similarities with Phong lighting. And in fact, up to some degree, Phong lighting can be derived by making that light source smaller and smaller. Yeah, so by making a limit consideration. Okay, but nevertheless, yeah. Now we know the formula how we can compute lighting correctly, and now we can do to make physically correct lighting. And in fact, the typical way to do that is the following. So we cannot solve that integral analytically, or in fact, we can do that for very simple cases, but we always have the problem with visibility. Yeah, if there's a visibility can be very complicated. Yeah, imagine here we don't have some blob in between, yeah, but we have a bunny object. Okay, I shouldn't try to draw a bunny. Yeah, then visibility is very complicated. Yeah, we cannot compute the integral of a bunny in terms of visibility, you know, analytically. There's no chance to do that. But we can approximate that. And the typical way to approximate is that we say, okay, an integral is in fact, yeah, an infinite sum. And we can take this infinite sum and replace it by a finite sum. We will make some error, but we at least get an approximation. Yeah. And so what we do is that we take a number of sample points on our light source. Yeah, we distribute these sample points uniformly on our light source. And for each of these sample points, we compute the integrand that looks like this here. And then we take the average. Yeah, integration is almost the same up to a factor as averaging. Yeah, so we compute that integrand on several points on that light source, yeah, and we just average, and this gives us an approximation for the integral. So essentially that's numerical integration. Yeah, instead of, yeah, you know these formulas. If we want to compute an integral of a normal function, we sample the function at multiple positions and average them, yeah, and that's exactly the same. Yeah, we, instead of integrating that function, we sample it on multiple positions of the light source and average. And that means, as a result, we take number of positions. For each, we compute the integrand, which means we compute the BRDF. Yeah, we assume essentially that this is a point light source, right? We compute the BRDF. We compute the geometry term, which has the 1 over r squared, but also the cosines at the sender and at the receiver. Yeah. The cosine at the receiver we always also took anyhow, and that at the sender is because, yeah, now we have a surface and not a omnidirectional point light source. Then we compute the visibility. That means we cast a shadow ray, yeah, and that is costly. If we have an area surface and we want to sample it by 100 samples, for instance, that means we have to shoot 100 shadow rays. Yeah, that's a lot. And we are done. We are summing all that up. This is the brightness of the light source. Here we assume that it's constant, so it's a constant. It can be also pulled in front of the sum. And then we have an algorithm, right? And the benefit now is we can physically correctly handle area lights. We get soft shadows, because now for every light source, for every surface point, we don't have one single shadow ray, but maybe 100 shadow rays. Yeah, so we get at least discretized soft shadows. Yeah, but we also have a lot of work more to do. Yeah, because we have 100 shadow rays. This is how we compute this visibility, just to illustrate that again. And here we can see results, how that looks like. On the left, we have a cylinder illuminated by a point light source. Yeah, and we can see that it's rather sharp. In fact, that's also an area light source, but a rather small area light source. And this is a larger area light source. Yeah, and now you see we clearly don't have a binary shadow, but we have such a soft shadow where we have a smooth transition from illuminated to black. You can also see another interesting effect here, and that is that the shadow is sharper if it's closer to the object silhouette that generates the shadow, and the further you get away, the blurrier it gets. Yeah, that's a typical effect. Of course, it automatically comes if you do that correctly, but there are some approximate methods for soft shadows that don't have this effect, and so it's very, very simple to find them, to detect them, if you know what you have to look for. Now, this is an interesting observation in that the sampling strategy is important. I told you we choose samples on our light source and compute the integral by sampling. And now if we take a very simple strategy and always take a uniform grid on our light source, yeah, then essentially we replace our area light by a grid of point lights, and the shadows we get look like this here. And now you see that our shadow is not a soft shadow as we would expect, yeah, but it's multiple hard shadows from constant points here, yeah, just on top of each other. Yeah, and here we just don't have enough samples, or we could reduce that by taking more samples. Yeah, that's already quite a bit. Okay, I don't know the number, but probably 32 or so. Yeah, and it doesn't look good at all. So we would need many more. And one option to do that better is, instead of taking for every pixel the same samples on top here, that for every pixel, yeah, so whenever we want to compute the illumination and to do that process here, we newly select samples on the light source, yeah, at different positions. And the easiest way to do that is just to use to select them randomly using a random number generator. So in that case, yeah, what we get is such a solution here. Now you see we don't have these banding artifacts here anymore, but instead now here we have noise, and this noise is just better, or looks better. And I mean, not for this low number, but if we now go to maybe 128, then we will have a nice solution. Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. So as I said, yeah, that's all only a little preview of what the lecture, or what is called global illumination. That's a research topic that is pretty well examined. Essentially, it is always around this formula here. Yeah. How can we compute this integral as fast as possible? Well, how can we compute the illumination at a point with as few ray samples as possible? Yeah, and as few ray samples as possible, because ray samples are expensive. Yeah, we can compute arbitrary precise solutions, but that would then take forever. How can we do that as efficient as possible? And what we can also do with that, so up to now we only have the reflection of a single area light source at a point. But if you imagine, what we could do now is the following. Yeah, we now know how to handle the illumination from a surface. What we can do now is that we compute the illumination on all surfaces in our scene, the direct illumination, and make this direct illumination our new light source. Yeah, so that means if I take a light and I illuminate a surface, yeah, then this surface by itself becomes a light source that can illuminate other parts in the scene. Yeah, and these indirectly illuminated parts of the scene again become light sources that can again illuminate other parts. And then we have a kind of closed loop. Yeah, we close the loop and we have all the indirect lighting effects also available. And we can do that by simply taking that equation that I've shown before, yeah, and making it recursive. And now we have the light at a surface point in a certain direction depends on this integral. And here, the emitted light of a surface, yeah, the light source contribution is this L again. Yeah, and this is what is illuminated by itself without interreflection, and this is the L itself. And now you see we have what is called an integral equation. This is what we are looking for, and it's defined using itself under an integral. So it's a recursive equation. This is the so-called rendering equation, because every ray tracing algorithm does nothing more but approximate or compute an approximate solution for this integral. And this is nice because we have a very, or rather simple equation, which is well understood, yeah, that describes our scenario. Yeah, what do we want to achieve? And we can always kind of test our results, yeah, by checking that they all approximate this equation here. Okay, good. So, I mean, don't worry, yeah, if that was a little bit too fast. Yeah, I only wanted to give you a little bit insight of what global illumination is about. And the nice thing is really that ray tracing can always be seen as a numerical method to find a solution for that rendering equation. Yeah, and this allows the development of many, many algorithms approximation techniques and so forth to solve that very simple equation. Okay, good. So that was another point, just kind of preview of what can come next. Finally, I would also briefly mention another nice thing with secondary rays, and these are so-called ray differentials. And the problem of ray differentials, or that is handled by ray differentials, is the following. In our ray tracing algorithm, what we typically assume is that we have single pixels on our image plane, and then we cast maybe a single ray through a pixel, and that ray represents the entire pixel. And we were also speaking about anti-aliasing, and I told you, of course, that will result in aliasing. So as an alternative, we can cast multiple rays through a pixel, and so sample the pixel. By the way, that's also numerical integration, right? So that's one option, but at latest, if we have things like curved surfaces, we will find out that they can even worsen that problem. If we look, for instance, let's say now this is a reflective sphere, a mirror sphere, and now we have eye rays, and these are kind of two extremal rays for a particular pixel, then we can rather well approximate how much they diverge. And for instance, if we assume that here we have a surface with a texture, we already spoke about that with MIP mapping, we can compute, that ray traveled a certain distance, how large is the footprint, and can, for instance, compute the right MIP map. But now if we have such a reflective sphere, obviously, due to the reflection, the divergence of the rays increases a lot. So if we want to do MIP mapping in that case, we don't really know here on that surface, what size of the footprint do we have? If we look at a single ray, how much these rays diverge is very difficult to find out. We ideally would like to have a way that does not only tell us for a particular ray how it travels, but also how big is that divergence. And here is another example that shows that. So this is a simple scene. We have reflection of that mirror object, and here we also have a magnifying glass. And now here MIP mapping is used. And for here for this sheet of paper, it works pretty well. So this is an inset of that part here. So you see here that looks rather well. But obviously, through the magnifying glass, there's too much blurring. Simply because the optical effect of that magnifying glass cannot really be considered. So what is done here is that rays traveling through the magnifying glass, they are refracted accordingly, as we learned it. And then the entire travel distance is accumulated, and this distance is used to find the right MIP map level. So that would work perfectly if there was no glass in between, but of course that magnifying glass has an optical effect. So that MIP mapping computation when looking through that glass doesn't work anymore. Okay, so how can we do that? So by the way, that's how it should look like, how it should look correctly. This is what we would like to see. And this is what we get here. Okay, and there's a simple trick. And again, it's rather mathematical, but I at least want to give a short sneak into this idea of what we can do here. And the idea is that if we describe a ray up to now, we always used something like E plus T times D. And this tells us we have a certain starting point and we have a direction. Yeah, and it defines a line. Yeah, and we have nothing like divergence of the ray or something like that. Yeah, we don't have information about the surrounding. Yeah, so we don't have some blurriness in our ray. And to add that, what we can do is that is the following observation or the following idea. So here I changed the notation a little bit because it's the notation from the paper. So maybe it makes easier if you go back to the paper if you're interested in that. They describe the ray like this: P plus T times D. Yeah, P is the starting point and D is the direction. And if we ask where does P and D come from, you remember it comes from this coordinate system that we can span with our camera. And we say the starting point of our ray is always the camera, and the direction we computed, yeah, using this formula here, which is a point on the image plane in front of the camera. Yeah, if you go back a little bit in the slides, you will find that formula, and that's normalized also. Okay, so what we can do now is that additionally with P and D, so P and D defines our rays, but additionally to P and D, we also remember or store now the derivatives of the ray. And with derivatives, yeah, we mean in that case, how much does P and D change if we would have moved our starting ray in X and Y direction? X and Y are the positions on the image plane. Yeah. So we take our image plane and this is our point where we shoot our ray through. And now if we move the starting point a little bit on the image plane, yeah, if we move it a little bit to the right, that would be dx. Yeah, we go a little bit to the right. How much does the starting point of our ray change? And for the I ray, it's very simple. The starting point doesn't change, yeah, because the I ray always is fixated at the I point. And this here is how much does the direction change? Yeah, and for the I ray, it's clear. Yeah, if I go a little bit upwards, I can compute how much does the direction change. Yeah, it's a very simple relation for I rays. So we do not only know now where does the point start and where does it go to, yeah, but if we go over the image plane, yeah, now we have a particular pixel, we have that starting point, and now we also know if we go a little bit to the right, how much do the parameters of the ray change and how much do they change if we go a little bit upwards? Yeah? So we have information. If we would have jittered the ray over our sample, yeah, how would it jitter in space when it travels? And yeah, now this can all be described mathematically. I mean, yeah, it's that's not trivial, but we can look up all these formulas and believe them. And the paper is pretty old, so obviously all the formulas were right. So what they start with is, so let's imagine, yeah, so for each ray, we do not only store these two parameters, starting point and direction, but also these derivatives. Yeah. And now we do, when we initialize the ray, yeah, an I ray, P, of course, is the starting point. D is the direction. As we know, the derivatives of the starting point are zero, and the derivatives for the direction can be computed using this formula, which is mostly complicated because it has this normalization, yeah, which when computing the derivatives makes things a little bit complicated. Okay, but that's just to be computed for each I ray once. Yeah, so that's okay. Now, that's boring up to now, yeah, but what we have now, yeah, that's the I ray. But now let's assume our I ray hits a surface. Yeah, so we have that I ray E and a direction, yeah, and now we hit a surface. And what we can compute now is not only the hit point, yeah, this is called P prime in this example, but we also know if we go This is our image plane. If we go a little bit in direction delta x, yeah, how does the hit point change? So essentially, yeah, we can compute the footprint of the hit point. Yeah, we go a little bit upwards on the image plane. Where do we hit now? Yeah, so this would be P prime going a little bit upwards, yeah, and this would be P prime going a little bit downwards, yeah. So we can approximate the hit point, yeah, if we are jittering the ray slightly around our original position. Yeah, that's these ray differentials. Yeah, we also have the differentials, the gradient. Yeah, if we go a little bit upwards, how does the hit point change? And yeah, this can be computed by using normal, yeah, algebra, computing derivatives and stuff like that. So for instance, for the hit point, the formula looks like that. Dp over dx, this is stored with a ray. That's exactly that term. So for now, yeah, no difference is made between the derivative with respect to x and y. It's all dx, but for y, it's all the same. Plus t times the derivative of the ray direction. This is also stored with a ray. And now plus dt over dxt. Yeah, this is a bit more complicated. Yeah, now this tells us how much does the ray parameter change when we go a little bit upwards or go a little bit to the right. How can we compute that? In particular, it depends on the surface normal at the hit point. Yeah, this is of course also needed because if in that example, or let's say this ray hits this surface, yeah, now P prime, yeah, varies a little bit. If we have such a surface, the very same ray changes much more, yeah, just because of the grazing angle. Yeah, so at some point we will also need the normal. And in fact, to compute that dt dx, yeah, we can use that formula here, and that also includes the normal. And this one also includes now again the derivative of d of the direction with respect to s, but this is stored in our ray description. Yeah. Okay, so essentially, yeah, I mean the formulas, how they look like is not important, but the idea is we define these ray differentials. Yeah, they are an additional parameter of our ray. Our ray does not only contain E and D or P and D in this notation, but also these derivatives, yeah, D blah blah blah. And now if we hit or compute an intersection, yeah, from this we can also derive informations about the hit point. And if we now shoot a secondary ray, yeah, we shoot it from here, and with these derivatives we can now compute the derivatives for the starting point of the ray. Yeah, so with the hit point we can, for the secondary ray, compute the derivatives for the starting point. So we do not only get the starting point of the secondary ray, but also again these ray differentials. Yeah, just using these rather simple formulas here. And for the reflection, now we also have to look at how these derivatives change if we compute the reflections. And to this, we again take this reflection formula and again compute the derivatives, and now something much more complicated appears. But it's all terms that we know. So here, for instance, we have the derivative for the direction. This is the scalar product of direction and normal. N is the normal of the hit point, by the way. So this all we know. And then there's interesting this here. This is the derivative of the normal at the surface point. And in fact, this is the curvature of the surface. The curvature of the surface, we can, I mean, rather quickly describe as follows. A flat surface has a curvature of zero because the normal does not change over the surface. On a sphere, the normal changes. And obviously, the smaller the radius of the sphere, the faster it changes. Yeah? So this has a high curvature, and this has a smaller curvature, yeah? Because here the normal changes quickly, and here it changes slowly. So a change of normal, yeah, how fast the normal changes over a surface, tells us its curvature. Yeah? And we can have curvature in this direction. In fact, that would be a negative curvature, and we can have curvature in this direction. This is a positive curvature. And this curvature is here. This is the derivative, yeah, the change of the normal over the surface. And it is clear that we want the curvature for this purpose. If we look at that example, yeah, the fact that the rays diverge here much quicker than when they come in on the surface is due to the curvature here. And of course, the magnifying glass from the example before, yeah, the magnifying effect comes from the curvature of the surface. Yeah. Okay. So here we have that nice effect now that the ray differential changes with the curvature. Yeah. And this shows that as soon as we have curved surfaces, we reflect off non-planar surfaces. Yeah. Here now, this all gives us new information. And in what we get in the end is something like this. We cast a ray in our scene. Yeah. We compute all these differentials, and then for a hit point, as I said before, yeah, we hit a surface somewhere here, and then these differentials tell us if I go a little bit to the right within the pixel, yeah, where would my ray have ended on that target surface? And if I go a little bit up, where would it have ended? So essentially, yeah, with this I can approximate, I cannot only trace through the center of a pixel, but I can trace really the contour of the pixel to some degree. And I can compute the footprint of the entire pixel on my target surface. And if you remember back, this footprint notion we used for texture lookup, for mipmaps. Yeah? And that's exactly what we want. Yeah? If we do texture filtering, yeah, we want to find out within our pixel, yeah, we want to project our pixel onto the object or into texture space. Yeah? And with that ray differentials, we get exactly this information, and we even get it correctly if we do it through lenses. Yeah? And this is how this has generated here now. Yeah? This is the good solution. A ray was traced through this magnifying glass with these ray differentials, and then in the end of the sheet of paper with the ray differentials, it could immediately be computed the footprint of the pixel on the sheet of paper. Yeah, and then it was just averaged over exactly that part, or just the right mipmap level has been chosen. And because this footprint here usually is not square but has an arbitrary shape, you know that anisotropic filtering is the better solution. Yeah, and this ray differentials directly give us the footprint. And yeah, this brings all these things together. Yeah, and now we have also nice anisotropic texture filtering through magnifying glasses and via reflective surface and so forth. Okay, yeah, that was a, I would say, more advanced topic. If you're interested in that stuff, there are lots of books and interesting papers, tutorials and whatsoever available on such stuff. I can in particular recommend that book, Physically Based Rendering, which for students, so if you come from a university IP, is available on Safari Books. It's maybe worth for you to have a look there. And the nice thing is that this is a ray tracer, so it's complete code of a ray tracing system with all these effects and many more. And the entire book is written around that code. So essentially, it's program code with comments, and the comments are the book. Yeah. So it really starts by describing all the little classes and getting bigger and bigger to algorithms and so forth. So it's a rather interesting concept. But there are also many other books that describe all that. Okay. So sorry for the 5 minutes extra. Next week, we will speak about accelerating ray tracing. How can we cast these rays as efficient as possible? Thank you.